Good afternoon and welcome to Desert Island Poems with Dame Eileen Atkins, introduced by Ursula Owen. So she's a great friend of the festival, and I'm going to do a celebrity Big Brother style introduction for her to say she is best known as founder of Virago Press, Ursula Owen.
Well, I would like to introduce our honoured guests, and we're so honoured that you've come, Eileen. And so this is Eileen Atkins, and she's going to keep you entertained for an hour. Eileen wanted to say something before we start.
It's just something I feel I have to say as we're going to be talking about my life. That my husband died 9 days ago after a long illness, and I know that he would have liked me to have kept my promise to come here. So if I haven't done it, I'm not going to excuse anything. I just want you to know that. Here we are.
Okay. Well, we're extremely pleased that you've come. I thought I'd start by just saying a few things about your life, and you can interrupt if I've got them wrong, because I probably have.
I probably will.
Just to say a bit about you. You will know, most of you will know quite a lot about Eileen. She's an actor and a screenwriter. She's worked in the theatre, film and television consistently for over 60 years, and she's still working. She's going to do her Ellen Terry one-woman show in Windsor Castle, is that right?
Yes, but I've done it for two sessions at the Wanamaker, and now I'm just doing the odd festival, but Windsor Castle really will be the last time I do it.
She was born in, I'm going to say this very carefully, the Salvation Army Nursing Mother's Home in East London.
Yes.
Did I get it right?
That's absolutely right, yes.
And your mother was 46.
Yes.
She was a seamstress, and she was a barmaid.
In the theatre, not in a pub. Big difference.
Her father was a gas meter reader, and once...
No, electric meter reader.
I knew this was going to happen. And once... under chauffeur to the Portuguese ambassador, though he couldn't actually drive.
He was 12 when he was assistant chauffeur to the Portuguese ambassador.
When she was three, her mother enrolled her into a dance class. And from the age of 7 to 15, she danced in working men's clubs for 15 shillings a time as Baby Eileen.
That's
Is that
it.
Right?
That's it. Yeah.
And during the war, she performed and sang for American troops. By 12, she was a professional in panto. She had a Cockney accent, and a woman who took an interest in her paid for her to be educated and try and get it removed. The principal of her school, Miss Hall, who you greatly admired, I gather, gave you firm and wise guidance. And then you went to Latimer School, where the Reverend Michael Burton spotted your potential and drilled away the last of your Cockney accent.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Okay.
Yes.
And he introduced you to Shakespeare, which was a major
aspect
of it.
Yeah.
You've always been outspoken, I'd say. At 14 or 15, you were taken to see Robert Atkins' production of King John, and you wrote to Robert Atkins saying the boy who played Prince Arthur was not good enough and that you could do better.
That's right.
He invited you to come and see him, but rather conveyed that you weren't ready yet. And then, by then, you were at Latimer School. You did a course at Guildhall School of Music and Drama, graduated in 1953, and went into acting. And you said it took you 9 years before you were working steadily.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think you should talk more about that. And I suppose, I mean, you're famous. When I looked at your list of achievements, they were just so astonishing, I didn't know where to start. but I've tried to pick out some of the most important ones. You're famous for your work on Shakespeare, your stage work on Virginia Woolf. You joined the Royal Shakespeare in 1957 and then the Old Vic. You've been nominated for and won BAFTAs and Emmy Awards, and the range of your work is quite astounding. Your first hit was the part as Childie in The Killing of Sister George in 1966,
yes.
Which made you extremely famous.
Suddenly put me on the map, yes.
Yeah. And you've also been in Gosford Park, you've been in Ibsen, and you wrote Upstairs, Downstairs.
No, I did not write Upstairs, Downstairs. I had the idea with Naughty Jean Marsh, who sometimes lets people say, and you wrote Upstairs, Downstairs. with my friend Jean Marsh, we conceived the idea for Upstairs, Downstairs and did a treatment for it and did all the characters and everything, but we never actually wrote a script. They wouldn't let us.
Because you were women?
Well, because we were women, very much. Because we were women, those silly little actresses.
Wow. And you never appeared in it either?
No, I didn't want to appear in it because in those days, it is different now, but I think I would still feel a bit the same. In those days, I don't know whether to talk to the audience or you, Ursula. You're so engaging, I want to talk to you. But I have a few. In those days, if you played a part on television, you were known as that part on television. And I didn't think that was a good idea anyway. And it wasn't what I'd gone into the business for. I'd gone into the business to play different parts, to be, as we were called then, and I really much prefer, an actress. That was why I'd gone into the business, and to play different things. And if you just play the same part week after week after week after week, it's to me, that's exceptionally boring. So I wouldn't be in it. They were very upset that I wouldn't be in it. But I just wouldn't be in it. I am now in a series, but I'm a very old lady now, and it's nice to have 4 months in Cornwall every so often.
Which I love. I love Doc Martin. I'm a great fan of yours.
Oh, good.
And Doc Martin. So that was the other thing, which you've met, probably many of you know, Doc Martin. I'm just going to tell one little anecdote before we get on to poetry, which is your robust attitude to life and aging. You laugh a lot and you like having fun, and you describe being in Cranford when you were, you had more fun on it, you said, than any job. And thanks to the company of Britain's unbotoxed best, including Dame Judi Dench, Julia McKenzie and Imelda Staunton. And then this is you talking. At one point, Judy, who played Deborah's sister Miss Mattie, and I were crammed into a tight space waiting to make our entrance in a scene, and Judy whispered urgently to me, "Come on, tell me, have you had anything done?" And I said, "Judy, if I'd had anything done, would I look like this? Come on."
That is
very...
That? Sorry, were you going to...
No, I just...
There was a rather charming thing happened on... Oh, actually, I must tell you a very funny thing that happened on Cranford. But there was one thing to follow on from that, was that... what's his name? The chap who plays the butler in Downton Abbey. Jim somebody. Jim was... We were filming in a church one day, and Judy Dench and I were laughing so much. We'd do a bit, and then we'd laugh again. And Jim came up to us afterwards and said, "I've been behind you up there thinking, in what other profession could you find two women in their 70s still working and laughing their heads off continuously in their work?" And he said, "What lucky people we all are," and we are lucky people. But I must tell you the funniest thing that happened on Cranford. You know, when you do a shot, I find filming terribly boring, and I much prefer the theatre. But Judy and I, one scene, had to be at the gate receiving Lisa Dillon, who was arriving in her character. And I had to say, she arrived in a coach. She came to the gate of where Judy and I, of our front garden, where we were receiving her, and I had to say, "It is a pleasure to welcome you to Cranford, Miss Mary," or whatever her name was, I can't remember. And, you know, we'd done it already, and the horse and the carriage had landed in the wrong place three times. The steps had fallen off the carriage once. A cameraman had messed up the next day. We were on about the seventh or eighth take. And in your head, you know, you've always got another conversation going on as well as being the character. And I was thinking, oh, my God, the horses are in the right place there. Oh, they've got the steps down. Oh, Lisa's come down without falling over. Here we go. You're up for it. Here's your line. "It is a pleasure to welcome you to Ambridge." Judy and I are both avid Archers fans. And we laughed so much, they had to remake us up.
Right. We should probably get down to poetry.
Now we have to get serious.
I just wanted to ask you, do you remember when you first heard your first poem and what it was?
No, I can only remember, which is utterly bizarre, not a poem, a rhyme. I can only remember I had one or two days at school before war was declared in Tottenham, and then I didn't go to school again until I was seven. And I can only remember the teacher saying, this is not poetry, doing, "I love little pussy, her coat is so warm, and if I don't hurt her, she'll do me so harm." And I remember saying it with a very beautiful little boy called Gordon. And I thought, if this is school, I like it. But poetry, no. Poetry came when I started having to do poetry to get rid of my accent, to go to festivals so that people were accepting me as not having a Cockney accent.
Right. Well, Eileen's chosen eight poems, and I think we should start with the first one, and I think you need to explain exactly why you've chosen each one.
Put me on the spot straight away. It's not a poem, actually, but I think most of us know it as a poem. It's John Donne's Meditation 17. And I've chosen it because of the referendum. And I can't help thinking that it wouldn't have done any good. But I just think it's a very good reminder to us all of what John Donne said and what I utterly believe. "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee."
You got some of the other poems of your choice also touches on lots of things, but certainly touches on what's going on in our world at the moment. But then to go to the next poem, which is Ithaca by C.P. Kafafi, as far as I understand it, that touches on your passionate feeling about journeying, not just literal journey, but journeying through life, yes.
I think this is the most perfect reminder of how we wouldn't enjoy life if there wasn't death. And it would be quite terrible without death. As long as you have you have a long one. And this, I simply love this poem. I think it's beautiful. Ithaca. As you set out for Ithaca, hope your road is a long one, full of adventure, full of discovery. Lystragonians, Cyclops, angry Poseidon, don't be afraid of them. You'll never find things like that on your way, as long as you keep your thoughts raised high, as long as a rare excitement stirs your spirit and your body. Lystragonians, Cyclops, wild Poseidon, you won't encounter them unless you bring them along inside your soul, unless your soul sets them up in front of you. Hope your road is a long one. May there be many summer mornings when, with what pleasure, what joy, you enter harbors you're seeing for the first time. May you stop at Phoenician trading stations to buy fine things, mother of pearl and coral, amber and ebony, sensual perfume of every kind, as many sensual perfumes as you can. And may you visit many Egyptian cities to learn and go on learning from their scholars. Keep Ithaca always in your mind. Arriving there is what you're destined for. But don't hurry the journey at all. Better if it lasts for years, so you're old by the time you reach the island, wealthy with all you've gained on the way, not expecting Ithaca to make you rich. Ithaca gave you the marvelous journey. Without her, you wouldn't have set out. She has nothing left to give you now. And if you find her poor, Ithaca won't have fooled you. Wise as you will have become, so full of experience, you'll have understood by then what these Ithacas mean.
You've already referred to one rather shocking moment in your life when it didn't seem right that you should write the scripts because you were women, or that's what you implied.
Oh, yes.
Of the upstairs, downstairs, and you are a woman, and you're in a world, and you're a woman of a certain age, and you've lived in a world which...
Very old age, not a certain age.
Which, you know, has marginalised women... less than used to be, but still marginalizes. You had a very wonderful, interesting quote. I'm doing this as a to lead up to the next poem, which actually I'd like you to explain to me, because I'm not sure I entirely understand it, which is about sex. But I also think it's interesting that I found a quote from you saying something about the Taming of the Shrew. The Taming of the rather contentious quote. The Taming of the Shrew is an awkward play for gender relations, but there are still a lot of women who would marry a man such as Petruchio and get treated as Katharina does and enjoy being told to go into the kitchen and shut up. I just don't think you can block out the idea that some women desire subjugation. I'm getting into dangerous waters here. But the fact that ISIS can attract women to go to a life in which they know they will be totally subjugated, I'm afraid shows that there is something in the female psyche which desires that. Explain.
Well, to my observation, not necessarily my experience, but a little bit of excitement. I mean, I've touched on it in my life. I find that to be true, no matter how much some women might like to not think that's true. There's no doubt that some women enjoy that. I've heard another actress, a wonderful actress, say to me that's exactly what she likes, when she likes to be ordered about the minute she gets off the stage. But I mean, oh, I could go deep into this, but I'm not going to go into it. I'm getting to it. I mean, John Mortimer used to always tell me that I'm going way off script here. I mean, not that we had a script, but I know I'm going too far already. John Mortimer told me that judges, well, inevitably, a huge percentage of them then liked sadism, liked to be whipped or something, because they'd spent all day handing out punishment to people. So there's a sort of, there's a part of this in women too, I think, that in this actress maybe, who was very, very successful, maybe she needed that. But no, I mean, when you think of all the women who used to nuns and prostrate themselves. If you read all of the women's poetry, and this is the reason, this is next poem to me, is how I feel about love. And I searched all the women poets I could to try and find out someone with my idea of love. And I couldn't find a poem. And then I found this, and it's by Yeats. And I thought, how odd, I found a poem that says exactly what I think, but it's by a man. And then I thought, well, maybe, Eileen, you've just got a masculine mind. You've got a masculine attitude, which, of course, is quite possible. But I know Ursula doesn't quite understand this poem.
No, I think I'm...
At all.
Dumb. I don't think I entirely understand.
To me, it's the difference between loving bodily and then when you truly have a real love takes you over. And this, to me, is the difference between bodily love and... Well, he calls it the love of souls, but I mean real love. What lively lad most pleasured me of all that with me lay? I answer that I gave my soul and loved in misery, but had great pleasure with a lad that I loved bodily. Flinging from his arms, I laughed to think his passion such. He fancied that I gave a soul, did but our bodies touch, and laughed upon his breast to think beast gave beast as much. I gave what other women gave that stepped out of their clothes. But when the soul, its body off, naked to naked goes, he it has found shall find therein what none other knows, and give his own and take his own, and rule in his own right. And though it loved in misery, close and cling so tight, there's not a bird of day that dare extinguish that delight. And I understand that will be contentious. I understand there's many a woman who would think it dreadful to sleep with anybody who wasn't their one love, their husband. But let's face it, it does happen.
That's not my problem. My problem is I don't think I quite understand why the one where there's soul coming to soul...
Is miserable. Yes, of course it is, because it's too hard.
Right.
It's so, when you really feel with every fibre of your being, it's hard. You can't throw it away. If it doesn't mean much to you, but life, even if you find it, life, let's face it, isn't a bowl of cherries every day. Mm. Life is hard.
Yep.
And it's so much, if you really care to your core about someone, then it's painful sometimes, even when you know they love you. But that's how it is.
Yep.
Or you think they love you, or you hope they love you.
So we're going to, from love and its difficulties, to joy.
Oh, yes.
Mind you, love it. I mean,
I didn't mean to get into that either.
I don't know how to pronounce this person's name. Do you?
No, Lee Yung Lee.
I think that might be Lai. Do you think? Lai Yung Lee?
Okay.
Anyway, I looked him up, but I didn't think how to pronounce it. Well, it's just that, there's such joy in ordinary things. It's very difficult to find joyful poetry. That's to start with. People tend to write slightly mournfully when they get to poetry. And it was difficult to find something joyous. And I get huge joy out of utterly ordinary things. I mean, if the heron lands outside my house every day, that's a lift for the day. I saw the heron this morning. And I would say to my husband, and it's still the heron coming back. I love it. I live on the river, and the water birds are fabulous. And food, I love food. And, such pleasure from good food. I could never not care about the food I'm eating. And this, I think, gives that kind of... And, it's all part... This is the tiny things that make up the good things of life. And here is From Blossoms, by Lee or Lai Yung Lee. From blossoms comes this brown paper bag of peaches we bought from the boy at the bend in the road where we turn toward signs painted peaches. From laden boughs, from hands, from sweet fellowship in the bins, comes nectar at the roadside. Succulent peaches we devour, dusty skin and all. Comes the familiar dust of summer, dust we eat. Oh, to take what we love inside, to carry within us an orchard, to eat not only the skin but the shade, not only the sugar but the days, to hold the fruit in our hands, adore it, then bite into the round jubilance of peach. There are days we live as if death were nowhere in the background. From joy to joy to joy, from wing to wing, from blossom to impossible blossom, to sweet impossible blossom. Now that makes me cry.
Well, can I pause for a moment and say, what has poetry meant to you in your life? I mean, it doesn't really matter what happened to me, but I know that for me it came very late, reading poetry, that it's a deep comfort, that it's a joy, and I didn't have it when I was younger. And I wondered, because some of your life has been quite difficult with your relationship with your parents over acting and things, was poetry something you turned to as a way of being comforted, understood?
No, of course Shakespeare's always meant a great to me, and that's poetry. But I, it was more the, when I was. I think we appreciate it more as we grow older.
Yeah.
I know Alec Guinness, for example, said to me when he was in his 80s, "I've stopped reading anything but poetry." And I think when I was at school, we had a poetry competition. It was always a competition when I was doing it in my early teens, you know. And then this wonderful teacher who made me appreciate Shakespeare he simply handed to me. I wasn't that mad. I did poetry. It was quite fun. Oh, I'm coming downhill on a bicycle or something like that, you know. And oh, look, I'm doing it nicely and isn't it fun? But I didn't really read much into it. I will go down to the seas again or something. It was all right, but I didn't think much about it. And then he came to me and gave. He was so clever to do this. He used to take me for lessons after school every day for nothing. He never got paid a penny. 4 or 5 times a week, and he handed me a piece of paper which had a speech from Helena, A Midsummer Night's Dream, but he'd written it in prose, as if, here's another part for you. And he said, read it and do it, and I did it. And he said, now, what do you think about that piece? And I said, oh, well, there's this girl who's in love with this boy and he's not in love with her and she's fed up and she's trying to say, oh, don't love her, love me. Why don't you love me? And he said, anything else about it? And I said, well, it's funny, but it seems to me like poetry. And he said, it is poetry. And he said, that's Shakespeare. And it made me never, ever afraid of Shakespeare. Because the first piece that it handed me was me at school, a girl who was in love with a boy who didn't love her, who was following her around. And it was quite ordinary to me because I didn't see it in a book all laid out. And then, of course, once you get to do any Shakespeare, then you realize how terribly important his iambic pentameters are and how the poetry gives you the rhythm and the sense, and then it gets terribly exciting, and you're looking for the clue. Then, of course, for an actor, the easiest thing in the world to learn is Shakespeare, because you know you must have a word there because the rhythm is there, and the best. If you have difficulty learning a part, it's nearly always because there's not enough rhythm. Even Pinter, which is very difficult to learn, but it has a rhythm in there. So you finally learn a rhythm. And the best writers have their own rhythm. And now, this has been very comforting for me because I'm afraid I've been so taken up with my husband's illness that I knew I had this festival, but I wasn't doing anything about it. And then I've had just this week to look and choose. And it's been enormously good for me to have been every night reading masses of poetry. And I found it very comforting. So I think maybe young people, depends, I don't know. For me, it didn't really mean anything until my middle years. I think.
Didn't it? But what about Shakespeare? That was... Once you got hooked on Shakespeare,
That was it. I just love it,
and always did from an early
age. Right from 12. I mean, I think I wrote to Robert Atkins, and I told him that the boy playing. I was 12, and I told him that the boy playing Arthur in King John was no good, and that I would be a lot better. And he said, well, you better come along and see me then. All this was written. He didn't know that I was only 12. And I dressed myself up and put makeup on. God knows what I told my mother. She certainly didn't know I was making my way to Regent's Park at 12 to see Robert Atkins. And I walked into the dressing room. I was directed to his dressing room. And I knocked on the door. And he said, who the hell are you? And I said, I wrote to you about Prince Arthur. You told me to come and see you. And he said, well, look, I don't give jobs to shop girls. And I should have been upset. I wasn't at all, because I didn't think that shop girls were anything to be despised. So I it was just a statement of fact. I said, no, I'm not a shop girl. I'm a school girl. And then he had a good look at me and said, well, you better come in the tent and see what you can do, because it was raining. And I auditioned for him, and he said, go away and go to drama school and come back to me and I'll give you a job. And he did. He gave me my first job.
Did he?
Yes.
Oh, good story.
So we then come to one of my favourite poems, which I suppose is a poem about historical pessimism and falling back on personal values, which is Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. I don't know why did you choose it?
I really love this poem. It's a wonderful poem. It's how hard it is to live. It's how hard it is to live without faith. It's how hard it is to live, but it somehow isn't depressing.
No, that's true.
So, the sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window, sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles, long ago, heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind on the vast edges, drear and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night.
I haven't really asked you very much about your family. Your parents were not well off, and your mother very much encouraged you to be a dancer, but you've talked to me a bit about how she didn't really want you to be an actress.
No, she was told by a gypsy at the door when I was three and had gone to the door with her, a gypsy coming selling heather, and she was very superstitious, that I was going to be a great dancer. And she sent me off to dancing lessons when I was three, and I screamed and said I hated it and take me home. And then she took me again when I was four and I screamed. And finally, I told a wonderful lie the third time she took me. I said, I don't want to go there again. And I totally made it up. I just didn't want to go dancing. I said, I shall never forget this. I said, there's a nasty girl there. and she puts my head down the lavatory and puts flashes. No, she didn't at all. And the poor girl got bumped from the dancing class. I probably ruined her life. But then I was quite good at it. And I did working men's clubs from the age of 7 to about 15.
That must have been amazing, because they're quite sort of rowdy. And did they treat you well?
What can I say? I don't think it's a... If I had my way, I would stop all children being entertainers.
Yeah.
I would say, everybody, you've got to do without the kids. I don't know how you do it, but do without it. Because on the whole, I think it is very bad for children. It didn't ruin me, but in any way, I got on with it. I was quite robust about it. But, it's not particularly... I mean, why do a bunch of men in a club want to see a kid of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 dancing in short clothes? It's dodgy. And I wasn't actually harmed by it, but I really don't like it. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 12 and this world of Shakespeare was opened up to me and this different kind of theatre, I just became passionate about it. But my parents had never been to theatre. My father used to wonderfully take me to the musical, which I loved, and we used to go to the musical a lot. And that was I loved that. Got a lot from that. But they didn't want me to be in plays, especially the kind of plays I'm in. I like very what's known as serious work. I wasn't in Brian Ricks or, a farce, though I enjoy going to them. I've got nothing against that. But the work for me if I'm going to work, if I'm going to be in something, then I want to be mostly in something with some... some stuff to it. So I want it to contain something deep. And my poor mother had to sit through... she was just distressed. And also I was in stuff that nobody else in the street in Tottenham knew about. I do remember one, and I will tell... my brother's in the audience, and he'll get cross about this. But I will tell, at one point, I just played Celia Copperstone in the Deep Blue Sea. Not Deep Blue Sea, in the Cocktail Party. And, this is an intensely serious play. And that Sunday, after we'd opened, I went to my parents' house for lunch in Tottenham. And, it was a huge success, the Cocktail Party with Alec Guinness. And I got there and I'd been up the allotment and admired the allotment, and I'd gone back and we'd had lunch, and I said that was lovely, though my mother was a really dreadful cook. And I'd noticed the new curtains and I'd said about that. And finally, at about sometime in the middle of the afternoon, I said, have you... read any of my notices for the Cocktail Party? And quick as a flash, my mother said, "Yes, you weren't the Daily Mirror's idea of a martyr." And it's a joke, but because it was important, because the Daily Mirror was the only thing read in that street. So I wasn't much... it was hard for them to be proud of what I did. She was proud, but in a very... she didn't quite understand what I was doing. Neither of them did.
And was that difficult for you, or did you find that difficult? Did it discourage you or not?
I think I was probably in the wrong that I didn't try to make it all right in some way. Older now, I probably behave badly. I think, oh God, they've got to sit through this again. They won't know what that is. They've got Strindberg tonight, but I think that was wrong of me. I don't think I understood well enough.
Let's go to the next poem, which I'm afraid I've lost. No,
it's
Musée des Beaux-Arts by W.H. Auden. So tell me about why you chose this.
Yes, because it's so exact, isn't it? It says it itself. You know that these terrible things happen, and you forget that somewhere else something quite jolly is happening. And it's I think he's got it better. And I love going to galleries, and I love painting, and so it's, I know, he's just got it right. It's just a comment, really, on how we all live, with the suffering and the joy. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on the pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course anyhow, in a corner, some untidy spot where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on.
Before we get to the next poem, which is about men and women, I just want to say, when you've been married twice, once to an actor and once to a director, is that right?
And the first time to an actor, Julian Glover, who some of you might know, he's in Game of Thrones at the moment, I think. And my second husband was, he did all kinds of things. But when I met him, he made commercials, and I was so scathing about anyone who spent their life making commercials that I practically made us bankrupt because he made a movie.
Well, I was going to ask, but it's clearly an unnecessary question. Was there anything inside those marriages that made your relationship to acting change? Did you feel held back or encouraged? I guess you did your own thing. That's what it sounds like.
I think it can be summed up in the fact that I married my second husband after only knowing him 2 or 3 weeks. I can't remember.
Really?
Yes, it was a moment of madness. And all I said to him was, and I think that answers your question, all right, fine, we're getting married, but I go to America or wherever work comes whenever I want to, and you never argue about it. And I don't do breakfast and I don't do shirts.
Well done.
That was the deal.
Well done. You got there sooner than most of us, I think.
Yes.
So I also love this next poem, which seems to me full of spite and love and regret and everything one wants to say about difficult relationships between men and women. It's called Mrs. Midas, and it's by Carol Ann Duffy.
Also, to me, it shows, I don't know, I don't understand, I'm a bit silly about money. I've sort of ended up with just about enough, which is fine. But why people want to earn millions and millions and millions and millions, I don't know. And this bit says that too.
It does.
It was late September. I just poured a glass of wine, began to unwind while the vegetables cooked. The kitchen was filled with the smell of itself, relaxed, its steamy breath gently blanching the windows. So I opened one, then with my fingers wiped the other's glass like a brow. He was standing. Oh, I realise I should have said what it's called.
I said Mrs. Midas.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm going to start again. It was late September. I'd just poured a glass of wine, begun to unwind while the vegetables cooked. The kitchen, filled with the smell of itself, relaxed, its steamy breath gently blanching the windows. So I opened one, then with my fingers wiped the other's glass like a brow. He was standing under the pear tree, snapping a twig. Now, the garden was long and the visibility poor, the way the dark of the ground seems to drink the light of the sky. But that twig in his hand was gold. And then he plucked a pear from a branch we grew from Dante Totom, and it sat in his palm like a light bulb. On. I thought to myself, is he putting fairy lights in the tree? He came into the house. The doorknobs gleamed. He drew the blinds. Well, you know the mind. I thought of the field of the cloth of gold and of Miss MacReady. He sat in that chair like a king on a burnished throne. The look on his face was strange, wild, vain. I said, what in the name of God is going on? He started to laugh. I served up the meal, for starters, corn on the cob. Within seconds, he was spitting out the teeth of the rich. He toyed with his spoon, then mine, then with the knives and the forks. He asked where was the wine. I poured with a shaking hand a fragrant, bone-dry white from Italy, then watched as he picked up the glass, goblet, golden chalice, drank. It was then I started to scream. He sank to his knees. After we'd both calmed down, I finished the wine on my own, hearing him out. I made him sit on the other side of the room and keep his hands to himself. I locked the cat in the cellar. I moved the phone. The toilet I didn't mind. I couldn't believe my ears. How he'd had a wish. Look, we all have wishes granted. But who has wishes granted? Him. Do you know about gold? It feeds no one. Aurum, soft, untarnishable, slakes no thirst. He tried to light a cigarette. I gazed entranced as the blue flame played on its luteous stem. At least, I said, you'll be able to give up smoking for good. Separate beds. In fact, I put a chair against my door, near petrified. He was below, turning the spare room into the tomb of Tutankhamun. You see, we were passionate then, in those halcyon days, unwrapping each other rapidly like presents, fast food. But now I feared his honeyed embrace, the kiss that would turn my lips into a work of art. And who, when it comes to the crunch, can live with a heart of gold? That night I dreamt I bore his child, its perfect all limbs, its little tongue like a precious latch, its amber eyes holding their pupils like flies. My dream milk burned in my breasts. I woke to a streaming sun. So he had to move out. We'd a caravan in the wilds, in a glade of its own. I drove him up under the cover of dark. He sat in the back. And then I came home. The woman who married the fool who wished for gold. At first, I visited odd times, parking the car a good way off, then walking. You knew you were getting close. golden trout on the grass. One day a hare hung from a larch, a beautiful lemon mistake. And then his footprints glistening next to the river's path. He was thin, delirious. Hearing, he said, the music of Pan from the woods. Listen. That was the last straw. What gets me now is not the idiocy or greed, but lack of thought for me. Pure selfishness. Oh, I sold the contents of the house and came down here. I think of him in certain lights, dawn, late afternoon, and once a bowl of apples stopped me dead. I miss most, even now, his hands, his warm hands on my skin, his touch.
It's marvellous.
Fun, isn't it?
Marvellous.
Well, we've come pretty much to the last poem, which you chose very early on, and you always chose it as the last poem.
Yes, yeah.
And you were right. And it's, I suppose, part must be about your deep love of London, which I've gathered from conversations with you already that you have. Have you lived in London?
Well, I did. I when we lived in Tottenham, I used to love going into the West End, as we call it. I loved going to the centre of London. And I always remember the journey home, and you came by the last arch, you came through Regent's Park, and then you came to Camden Town, and there was a picture of a little girl holding out a bowl with water or something in it for animals. And I always, when I saw that picture, I thought, from now on, it's ugly. I always used to think that. I'm very, very, I have to tell taxi drivers to take certain routes because some routes depress me going down the street.
Yeah.
And so the minute I had a chance to be away from home and be living in London, which was with my first husband, when we came down from Stratford, where we're lucky enough to start, we lived in Earl's Court, and though it was a bit of a shock after Stratford to be right in the middle of Earl's Court, I have always loved London. I also love New York, and the two cities, I love going between the two cities, but I love London. And sometimes I have a moment of heartbreak when I see a building I don't love going up. And I hate seeing St. Paul's crowded out. But some of the new buildings are terrific. But it's the wonderful mixture of everything in London that I really love. And I didn't know that this poem was written by Wordsworth. You probably know this, but I didn't know this until someone told me. It was written by Wordsworth. He'd been to France and had an affair with a woman, and she'd had his baby. And he was about to marry in England. And he wanted to make things all right with the woman and make sure that she had enough money and everything. And he was on his way to see his child for the first time with his sister.
On
Westminster Bridge.
I didn't know that.
No. So, and I never knew that. But it doesn't make any difference. What I just think, and I would so like to be, I often say to myself, you must come down here one morning before the traffic is really up in any way. But it's, of course, it's hard now. But nevertheless, one day I'll do it. It's Westminster Bridge by Wordsworth. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare, Ships, towers, domes, theatres and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully steep in his first splendour valley, rock or hill. Ne'er saw I, never felt a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still. I love it.
Thank you. It's been absolutely wonderful. Talking to you and hearing you read above all was just marvellous. We never talked about whether... Am I supposed to ask whether what book you want to take?
I've never thought of it.
No.
Well, I'm afraid what book I would like to take is I wouldn't ask you to give me the whole volumes, but there is a wonderful copy of Virginia's condensed Virginia Woolf's diaries, and they would cheer you up every day, or they would me. She may have committed suicide with stones in her pockets, but while she was alive, she was the most vividly alive person that I know.
Yes, we didn't talk very much because you've done a lot of work.
Yes, a lot of her work.
Yes, wonderful. And a luxury?
Well, luxury, again, I haven't thought of a luxury.
No, I'm sorry, it's my...
Oh, God. I'm always getting into bed a huge duvet.
You can have the duvet, as Kirsty Young would say. Anyway, thank you so much. That's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, you've been a wonderful person to talk to as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't
think we have
time for questions. We're absolutely on and out. Do you want questions?
Well, you can if you like. They've just asked me if I want questions, but I think we're out of time.
We're out of time. Yeah. Sorry, folks.
If you haven't met Philippa, the manager of the festival, this is she. And she thanks Eileen with a bouquet. I have some other thanks. The festival wouldn't happen without all sorts of people, including the sponsors. And the sponsors of this event are Ormond Slade Solicitors. And we'd like to thank them very much for all the support they give to the festival. Absolutely. And thank you to many volunteers represented tonight by the stewards, Jo and her team, and one of the best tech teams in the business. Stuart is on sound for us tonight. So I've spent a wonderful hour, I'm sure you have. Can you imagine what joy I had 2 days having Dame Eileen Atkins read me the book at bedtime? Never mind the listeners, it was for me. So it's a delight to have had you here, and thank you, Ursula. Thank you all for coming, and please join me once again in thanking Ursula and Eileen.